zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip, heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zoom into the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha, 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hi there, everyone, and welcome to yet another edition of my science project on CITR 101.9 FM. I am your host, Julia, and just before we had our theme playing, we listened to what was a rather quirky performance by Richard Feynman, the noted physicist, and that was his Bongo Ode to Orange Juice. And that's an intro to one of today's themes on the show, scientists making songs and music, usually about their own research subject, or, and the quirks of doing their science. So we're going to listen to several of these examples of musical skill and wit, including recent offerings from something called the Geek Pop Festival that wrapped up at the end of February of this year. As per usual, we're also going to journey through some of the latest and not a little weird science news, as we like to do on this show. And I'm going to air an interview for you that I did very recently with a fellow named Derek Rancourt of the Skeletal Regenerative Medicine team here at the University of Calgary. Derek is, in addition to his own research, he's keenly involved with programs to help scientists, and particularly trainee scientists, develop what are referred to as soft skills, abilities and talents that scientists are stereotypically inept at, like teamwork, networking, and, close to my own heart, effectively communicating their own research. So if you are a budding scientist or know someone who is, or even if you're just curious about what kind of soft skills industry is looking for, tune in for that interview later in the show. And finally, there are some science events going on around town that I will share with you, cool stuff that you don't want to miss. I have a few interesting stories for you this week. One is a sort of continuation of something that Anne discussed, in particular during a show that we did on science, myths, and old wives' tales. I think it was actually our fundraising show that we did last fall. But in that story, Anne talked about the five-second rule, the idea that if you drop something on the ground, if you pick it up within 5 seconds, it doesn't actually pick up bacteria, and you can still eat it in complete safety. Well, there's a fellow named Paul Dawson of Clemson University's food science program, and he's now made it his business to root out the science behind these sort of popular myths that we have. And his formula is quite simple. It's to test the logic, or the lack thereof, behind pop culture myths or stories that started with the five-second rule. And Dawson's team found that no matter how quickly you pick up a piece of dropped food from the ground, it's crawling with all kinds of different bacteria. So having debunked the five-second rule, he then moved on with his students to another popular urban myth that many of us know of from the Seinfeld episode where George Constanza double dips a chip into dip and is caught at it, and a big discussion ensues about the etiquette of double dipping. So Dawson and his students designed an experiment where the students simulated Constanza's double dipping. And they dunked a snack cracker into sterile water several times, either with or without biting from the cracker between dips. What Dawson and his students found was surprising to everybody. Apparently, double dipping increases the number of bacteria in a shared bowl by about 3 times. So when you double dip, you triple dip the number of bacteria in there. The next myth that the group is up for testing is related to this five-second myth about dropping food and picking it up within a certain space of time. And this is the idea that if you blow on food that you pick up off the floor, you blow off any harmful bacteria. So this is really interesting stuff, and we'll try and keep an eye on it for you and follow up in future. This particular report on the double dipping was from the 7th of March, online posting from the Scientist magazine. So from bacteria, we move on to whales. Whales and cows. As you know, My Science Project loves its animal stories, and this is one that actually Anne forwarded to me that I thought was definitely worth a mention. A review of the controversial scientific research conducted by Japan and its whalers has uncovered a list of bizarre and what people are calling useless experiments, including how to crossbreed cows with whales. I think most of us know that female whales are often referred to as cows. This is kind of taking that a bit far. Scientists have analyzed 43 research papers produced by Japan over 18 years, and their conclusions were the findings of this scientific research was actually rather unscientific. It was useless or esoteric. The scientific research included injecting minke whale sperm into cow eggs and attempts to produce test tube whale babies, News Limited newspapers report. For years, Japan has continued its whaling program under the guise of scientific research, pretty much to the disgust of a lot of anti-whaling nations, including Australia, where this Japanese research was kind of brought to task. The head of Australia's scientific delegation to the International Whaling Commission, named Dr. Nick Gales, labeled the research bizarre, and he said it involved strange experiments, not just with cows, but with sheep and pigs and eggs. Now, at the International Whaling Commission meeting in London that happened earlier in March, Australia had planned to argue for the closure of the, quote, scientific research loophole in the commercial whaling ban, which has allowed Japan to continue its program. So essentially, it seems like Japan was just looking for any excuse to do wacky science on whales so that they could just keep hunting them for commercial purposes. I can't imagine. I'm trying to still get my head around a whale test tube baby. That's one hell of a test tube. The final animal story is about primates. As I guess this is like the ultimate My Science Project story. It's animals and it's primates. We love our monkeys at MSP. And this is about really, really old monkeys. Well, I shouldn't call them monkeys. They're fossils of tiny primitive primates called Teilhardina. And these Teilhardina fossils have been found on all three continents, Asia, North America, and Europe, around the world, dating to at least 55 million years ago, which was the time when the Earth was rather hot and humid, and it is a period of time called the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. Now, several teeth of these mouth-sized primitive primates have been unearthed in the Mississippi in North America, and they've been dated older than any other such fossils found in Europe or North America. What this evidence suggests is that these little primates traveled from Asia to North America across the Bering Land Bridge between Siberia and Alaska. Then they went on to Europe across another land bridge linking North America to Greenland in Scotland. This work was done by a paleontologist named Christopher Beard, who works at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh. And his new theory is sort of turning around the order of migration that was previously proposed. A fellow named Ken Rose, who's a mammal anatomist at Johns Hopkins, initially put forward that the Asia, Europe, North America itinerary was the one that these little primates took. What's sort of amazing about this either way, and it's a point that Christopher Beard makes, is that the Teilhardina primates are only about the size of a mouse and weigh about an ounce. So they're so small. But what's amazing to him is that these animals actually managed to migrate all the way around the Northern Hemisphere. It's not sure what happened to Teilhardina. Some people suggest that they do have living relatives in the way of today's tarsiers, which I'm sure all of us have seen tarsiers. They're tree dwelling, quite small primates, but they've got massive eyes. They're kind of like the equivalent of you having grapefruits for eyeballs. They've got these giant eyes, and they're nocturnal, and they have long tails and jump around in trees. So it's still up for debate which direction these little guys migrated in, but it's sort of humbling that they could be so small and get so far. Null Hypothesis, the Journal of Unlikely Science, is something that's based out of the UK. It started, according to the founding three PhD students, as many great ideas do, in the pub. Basically, these guys sat around and were disillusioned with the lack of opportunities for scientists in the UK, and moaning about the constant pressure to publish in the academic press, which basically led them to go and create their own online publication, that being Null Hypothesis. So as a part of their goings-on, Geek Pop Festival 2008 happened at the end of this past February, and it's an online music festival that showcased some brilliant unsigned bands whose songs have a science theme. If you want to check out all of these songs in their brilliant glory, simply go to www.null-hypothesis.co.uk, and you can search through there for the Geek Pop Festival 2008. The first song that I'll play from Geek Pop Fest is called Hotel Mauna Kea. As many of you may already know, the 4,200-meter-high summit of Mauna Kea in Hawaii houses the world's largest observatory for optical, infrared, and sub-millimeter astronomy, and thus is in very high demand from astronomers all over the world. You can go to their website, www.ifa.hawaii.edu/mko. And they have some information about getting to Mauna Kea. This song alludes to some of the challenges of working up there. First of all, you need a four-wheel drive vehicle to cope with the steep, unpaved road, or you can take a commercial tour. There are no opportunities for visitors to look through the telescopes at the summit, and visitors aren't allowed at the summit after dark. I suspect in large part this is because the observatory is in such high demand from scientists all over the world, and I imagine that the time on the observatory is booked up to like the second. Further, the website advises visitors that the road up the mountain can be dangerous, particularly in bad weather, and the high altitude of the observatory carries serious health risks, and this is quite cheery, routinely impairs physical and mental activity. So it sounds like going and doing your scientific research up at Hotel Mauna Kea, as the song is called, is perhaps a bit more challenging and daunting than one would imagine. Having said all that, this is the Photo Mixers with their contribution to Geek Pop 2008.
Baseline is drifting, spectrum looks weird. Are those emission lines? What's this dip over here? Will the referees buy it? Or is it just trash? Proposals are pending. I'm running out of cash. Welcome to the Hotel Mauna Kea. Such a dusty space. Such an arid place. We're living it up at the Hotel Mauna Kea. Any time of year, if the night is clear. Sleep deprivation, there's no air to breathe. Long drive to the summit, family's missing me. Flat tire on the dirt road, I can no longer drive. Will I miss dinner? Will they hold it till I arrive? Got an altitude headache, I can hardly see. I stopped drinking coffee, now I drink only tea. There's ice on the switchbacks, summit's out of reach. Can't do our science, let's go to the beach. Welcome to the Hotel Mauna Kea. Such a dusty space, such an arid place. We're living it up at the Hotel Mauna Kea. If the orbit is right, they might give us a night. The window is foggy, gone soft, the signal is dying, too much Cirrus aloft. Now the lasers are arcing, the guide camera's fried. I'm a victim of a disc crash, my career has just died. Last thing I remember, I was running for the door. I had to find the passage back to the lab I had before. Relax, said the PI.
It'll just take one more tweak.
Close the dome anytime you like. You can never leave.
You're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM. I am your slightly croaky host today, Julia. Got a little bit of a sore throat happening. I hope you'll forgive the scratchiness coming through the airwaves at you. I mentioned at the top of the show that I was going to share with you an interview that I had done with a scientist named Dr. Derek Rancourt about soft skill development for scientists. There's increasing talk in the scientific community about the need to develop and hone what are called soft skills. These aren't scientific or technical skills that we use in the lab or in our fieldwork, but they're abilities related to working well with others, developing professional relationships, and communicating information. One reason behind this movement is the fact that statistics show that due to largely a lack of job opportunities and very low federal funding, particularly in Canada, and an ever-increasing competition for research positions. For example, apparently 99% of all PhDs who have ever lived are alive today. These statistics show that between only 20 and 30% of PhDs and postdocs like myself or my co-host Anne actually make it into tenured research positions and are able to establish a foothold and get our own labs up and running. What this has led to is lots of science graduates who either are forced to leave academia for industry or choose to for various different reasons, and they go into either industry in the sciences or sometimes loosely related or even unrelated fields to scientific research. These private organizations require well-socialized and flexible team workers, and they look for this in their hiring process. Now, these traits have not traditionally been encouraged or fostered in science until recent years, when this big sort of mass migration out of academia started. And it still isn't the case in many labs and departments that soft skills are really acknowledged or emphasized or even formally instructed. So Derek Rancourt is very active in this, and he is pioneering programs at the University of Calgary in conjunction with other faculty to try and help graduate students and even postdocs to improve and hone their own soft skills. But before I play that interview, another resource for all you budding scientists out there is the Howard Hughes Medical Institute website. They have a page called Becoming a Scientist, where over 10 prominent and esteemed scientists, including UBC's own Dr. Brett Finlay, discuss in downloadable videos the qualities that they think are necessary to succeed in biomedical research, if not in other scientific disciplines. If you're interested in checking this out, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute website is www.hhmi.org/becoming/index.html. That said, here's my interview with Dr. Derek Rancourt about some of the soft skills that our generation of scientists needs and some resources on how to get them. In fact, we could call this interview Hard Facts About Soft Skills for Scientists.
My name is Derek Rancourt, and I'm an associate professor in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Calgary. I direct a course-based master's program in biotechnology, and this program merges science and business. And through this, I've come to realize the importance of paying attention to one's career development. In this program, the students have essentially 1 year to get their act together before they go into a company to do their practicum. And so we pay very close attention to their skill development during that year. And a lot of that skill development has nothing to do with academics, but more it has to do with their own professional development from a soft skill perspective.
So that's why you've become an advocate of soft skill development?
Absolutely. I've learned through this process that these are a lot of these skills are skills that I could have used when I was going through my senior graduate training and my postdoctoral training, and I think that would have equipped me better for finding a faculty position.
So what are soft skills for someone who hasn't heard that term before?
Some people call them employability skills. They're essentially divided into two broad areas. One is interpersonal skills, and the other is one's own professional skills, so one's own personal professional skills, so their effectiveness.
And so for scientists, you've talked a bit about the biotech and going into an industrial position after doing one's graduate training, but for scientists in particular, for those of us who stay and work in academia, why are soft skills important to those people?
Well, these days there's a lot of emphasis on working in multidisciplinary teams and working on much bigger projects. So whereas at one time scientists could survive and do well actually managing a small laboratory that was focused on one specific problem, these days there's a lot of emphasis on bringing people from different disciplines to address a problem. And often because these people from different disciplines don't necessarily speak the same language, it's important for scientists to actually be able to work in teams, and that requires a special amount of, professional development skills, or soft skills.
So that would include people skills and also personal effectiveness skills?
Yeah, absolutely. So, the personal effectiveness skills are going to have to do with your ability to manage yourself. So to be able to follow through on your commitments to the team, the greater team, for example. You could also argue that things like your leadership abilities are also things that could be considered personal effective skills, although they also impinge upon the ability to work with other people.
And even in the context of being a PI of one's own lab, I imagine these skills are rather essential.
Absolutely. So, the best laboratories are the ones that are being led by somebody who has very good interpersonal skills, someone who can actually inspire their team to work towards a goal, right? A common goal, to try to convince the team that the goal is laudable from their perspective, and that everybody works hard to achieve it.
Right, and there's also all those managerial aspects, too, to being
Absolutely.
A PI.
Yep.
That sort of nitty-gritty stuff that doesn't get instructed formally, at least, to,
That's right.
to graduate students and
yep.
even to postdocs. In that context, then, if these soft skills are so important to budding researchers and to scientific development for people who are both staying in academia and for those of us who do move on into industry, why isn't there some kind of formalized training, do you think, going on at the university level?
I think part of the problem is that the disciplines who oversee the training of the science don't feel like they have the qualifications to be training people in the area of skill development. There also is a lot of concern about diluting out the value of the PhD by incorporating too much material that would be related to soft skill development, for example. So instead, the interest on the part of laboratories or in departments is instead for students, for trainees, to actually seek out their own soft skill development rather than it being formalized through curricula.
So what would that involve, seeking out one's own soft skill development?
Well, I think the most important thing that one can do is to put together a professional development plan, which would encompass both the student or the trainee's desire to excel in science, but as well, at the same time, recognizing the soft skill development that they require to take them to a certain place, right? So it's really a matter of doing some serious introspection about oneself, to recognize one's weaknesses as well as one's strengths, and to try to develop strategies that would help one to shore up their weaknesses while at the same time perhaps exploiting their strengths. So when it comes to thinking about where one wants to be 5 years from now from a career development perspective, they're taking stock in themselves, and they're taking stock in what are the requirements, what are the competencies that are necessary for them to get that position, and they are developing strategies to help them attain that position by improving upon themselves. So really, it's about one's paying attention to constantly improving themselves to make themselves competitive in the market, in the job marketplace.
Right. So for the soft skill noob, someone who's not experienced with this sort of skill development and self-improvement, can we talk a bit about where they could go for information about even categories of soft skills? We've talked a bit about science communication and management and teamwork, but there are other things like presentation skills, specifically networking,
yes.
all sorts of other things. You've even written about effectively having meetings and using time wisely. So can you comment on real resources people could use?
Yes, so certainly most universities these days have a career center, for example, or a place where one can get assistance on developing their resumes and their CVs, and this is a good place to initiate a discussion about soft skill development. In addition to that, many universities also have leadership programs where part of that might involve having personality tests that a student can take to recognize what kind of personalities that they have. Some people are obviously soft spoken, for example, and that's an element of a personality, and if one recognizes their personalities and yet they recognize that there's a gap between what their particular personality type is and where they want to be and what are the expectations of personality type there, then they can start to make changes in their behavior or make a concerted effort to learn how to become more gregarious or outgoing. For example, if they recognize that being quiet or shy is going to prevent them from actually excelling in the job marketplace. So there are places to do tests like an example is the Kiersey personality test, which would allow you to sort of get a feeling of what kind of personality types you have. And this actually gives you a lot of insight into how you interact with other people, how you perform in teamwork, and that sort of thing. And so by having a good handle on your, not only your personalities, but your strengths and weaknesses, this can get you a long ways towards developing a program of introspection, which would allow you to recognize the areas where you're weak and the areas where you need to grow. So professional development planning is actually becoming a popular concept, and it's becoming a popular in the United States, in particular at the postdoctoral level. So a lot of people have recognized that a lot of postdocs are having difficulty finding faculty positions, and so they're often trapped. And so many of the professional societies in the United States now are encouraging postdocs to adopt this professional development planning process. So this involves, first of all, introspection, and it also involves in creating a strategic plan in terms of the types of areas that you want to develop, to become better at, and then also having interactions with your mentor, for example, who can actually comment on your strategic plan and help you to refine it. The mentor also plays a very important coaching role because they continually review your professional development plan and you're constantly improving it. But by having this dialogue with your mentor, this makes sure that you're actually following through on your plan or on your commitments, because that's one of the magical elements of coaching, and it's the reason why it's become popular in the business world. It's because it's easy to say you're going to do something. Putting it down on paper in terms of a professional development plan is actually a very good step. But people still tend to fall through the cracks in terms of not being able to follow through on their plans completely. So having that oversight on the part of a mentor can also help to motivate you to actually follow through on your commitments and to actually make sure that you're making progress in your plan. So mentors currently in science make sure that you are actually following through on your scientific goals, but it can also be very helpful for mentors to ensure that you are also following through on your professional development goals.
And mentors don't have to just be scientific mentors, right? They can be from other
Absolutely.
Areas.
In fact, I encourage people, especially if they are considering a position outside of academia, I encourage them to look for mentors outside of the university. So in my program, for example, every student is required to have a mentor in industry, because the expectation is that the majority of our students are going to go into companies, and the best mentors in that scenario are going to be people who have industrial experience and who can actually introduce the students into industry, you know?
And quickly, what's the straightforward way to getting yourself a mentor? If you've met someone that you think would be of value to you in your training, how do you approach them to see if they would go on board with you?
Well, first of all, being a trainee, especially being a student, is a wonderful card to play, because by introducing yourself as a student, you sort of are in a special group. And so if you can introduce yourself to somebody that you'd like to take on as a mentor, the idea would be, first of all, to approach them as a student, perhaps asking them for some advice. So it's very common, for example, to do something called informational interviewing, where you just basically ask somebody for 15 or 30 minutes of their time just to discuss their job or their career, what they're doing, just to get some information for yourself in case that might be of interest to you. And it is after you sort of develop that initial interaction that the opportunity might present itself to ask them to be your mentor. But I mean, obviously, you have to see the fit. So this person has to be somebody that you feel comfortable with, who's genuinely interested in you as a person, and you know that you can appreciate that they actually would be willing to give you more time if necessary to help with your own development. So in our program, we encourage our students to have at least one interaction with their mentor per month. And, you know, sometimes they get introduced through people within the program. Often what it is we have a list of people that we just show the students, and perhaps we have a bit of a dialogue as to what area of business are you interested in going in. And once we know that, we can sort of make some suggestions about who might be the best mentors because they work in that area, right? But I would imagine that a lot of it is just going to require research on the trainee's part in order to identify a suitable mentor, right?
For sure. I know that locally at the U of C, the Postdoc Association of Calgary has a website, and on that website they have resources for skill development for postdocs. Now, with the stem cell team, with that website, are there resources there that people can start exploring? I know you've also written quite a bit about skill development, and is that information available online to trainees?
So we have, in Calgary, we have developed a new resource that we're calling the BioProspects Learning Community, which is really a place for students to interact with people who have more experience in professional development as well as people who are in industry. And part of that, we also have a website that has a number of resources on it. So some of the material that I've written as well, and, you know, I might be interested in putting this podcast onto that website as well.
And what is that website?
www.blc.ucalgary.ca.
Great.
Good.
Is there anything else, any other websites that you think people might want to refer to?
Well, there are certainly career development websites. One that I'm aware of that's being developed or is probably pretty well developed is in Canada. It's called the BioTalent Canada. So this is basically the Industry Canada Sector Council for Biotechnology. And so they have, on that site, they have a lot of resources on jobs in biotech. And it boils right down to individual jobs with descriptions underneath them. So that's also a very good resource to explore. I think part of that site is also an area called the Petri Dish, which I think might also have more information on jobs in biotechnology in Canada.
Yeah, I've heard about that website. I think it does.
Yeah.
Just to wrap up, what's the take-home message?
As far as I'm concerned, the take-home message is that there's more to your development as a scientist than your technical expertise, that soft skill development, it plays a critical role. It's going to help you to become more competitive in the marketplace, whether it's in industry or in academia.
I try to be nice and take care of my appearances, keep out of trouble and trifle interferences. The Bachelor of Science, I run my own company. The Bachelor of Science, I run my own company.
Another song from the Geek Pop Festival 2008 is called The Scientist, appropriately enough. It's by a band that call themselves Tales from the Birdbath.
The scientist, she falls asleep. The scientist, pocket protector, and microscope. The scientist, corrective eyewear and lab coat. The scientist, the lab is silent at 1 a.m. The scientist, she's worked a long night once again. And the scientist, the motor. To the beat of the silence.
Fred Durst?
He's like Iggy.
Oh, you are sorely mistaken.
Play something from $3 Bill, y'all.
What is that?
That's the landmark Limp Bizkit album.
Limp Bizkit? Oh, my God. I mean,
Wait, you don't agree that those are the most crucial grooves you've heard since Funkadelic?
What, Limp Bizkit grooves? Yeah, absolutely.
It's like
know.
The ultimate cross between Funkadelic and Rob Tyner.
Yeah, no, I don't agree at all.
Oh, you do not deserve a radio show.
CITR 101.9 FM, your crucial groove station.
It's just a lot of BS. A whole lot of BS. It's just a lot of BS. A whole lot of BS.
They're waiting for a miracle. And you could be the answer to their prayers.
Before my transplant, I really never thought that I would live to be 25 years old.
The Organ Donation and Transplant Association of Canada asks you to consider making the gift of life possible for the thousands of Canadians waiting for their miracle.
After the transplant, I realized that I have such a life and such an opportunity to do everything that I wanted to do that I want to do it all. I'm able to do it all.
Please talk with your family about signing an organ donor card.
I know people going through the transplant process who might have grown up ill or become ill through a defect or a disease. There is light at the end of the tunnel. There is a life that you never expected before.
Find out more at organdonations.ca or phone toll free 866-949-0003.
My goal is to somehow let everybody in the world know about organ donations and have everyone talk to their family about donating an organ.
Find out more at organdonations.ca.
This is another song from the Geek Pop Festival 2008, which you can check out on the Null Hypothesis, the Journal of Unlikely Science website. This song is by someone named Johnny Berliner, and I think he probably fancies himself a cross between Tom Waits and that guy from the Pogues. This song is called Dark Matter.
Stuff consists of, it's not made from any particle that This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
So whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of
cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electro-pop lounge core.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, Brown.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds big, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville.
You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you, man, you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
And you're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM. I am your host, Julia. If you want to get in touch with either myself or my co-host, Anne, who is Vancouver-based, please email either of us at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. That is the name of our show, My Science Project, and the word radio at yahoo.ca. We have some science events coming up that I think that you guys may be interested in. The first is Café Scientifique. It's that time of month again, around the third Tuesday of every month. Café Scientifique happens downtown at the corner of Seymour and Dunsmuir Streets at Ye Old Railway Club. This Tuesday, March 25th at 7:30 p.m., Café Sci presents Dr. Cheryl Wellington of UBC's Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine. And Cheryl's going to talk about the early bird remembers the worm, a discussion of the origins of Alzheimer's disease. The event is, as always, totally free. Everyone is welcome. If you're a scientist, grab a non-scientist pal, drag him along, buy him a beer. It'll be a great night. Another event that is happening a little bit further into the future, but I wanted to mention it now because it requests registration from participants, is called Celebrating Women's Health. I suppose this is appropriate since we had International Women's Day just a couple of weeks ago. But this event is actually happening Thursday, April 24th. It's totally free. It's being co-sponsored by the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology, or SCWST. And you can go to their website, www.scwist.ca. That's www.scwist.ca for detailed info. Basically, this event celebrating women's health is an evening with internationally known health activist Judy Norsigian. She's going to be in Vancouver to talk about the global reach of the now classic book on women's health, Our Bodies, Ourselves. Dr. Joy Johnson, who is the director of the Institute of Gender and Health for the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, we'll open the evening with a discussion of the advances in women's health research in Canada. SCWST is very proud to co-sponsor this free event, which is open to anybody with an interest in women's health, male, female, whatever. Guests can attend in person, or this is quite cool. If you can't make it in person, there's going to be a live webcast over the internet that you can participate in. So on April 24th, the event runs from 6:30 till 10 o'clock at night. If you can go in person, make your way down to the Vancouver General Hospital to the Peitsold Auditorium. Even though the event is free, because space is limited, people are being asked to register, Of course, if you want to do the live webcast, you don't need to worry about it, but you can visit www.whrn.ca for registration and for more details. And if you'd like to volunteer to help with the event, you can get in touch with SQIST again through their website, www.squist.ca. That's about it for this week's show. Anne returns to the airwaves in 2 weeks' time with all sorts of cool science stuff for you. Next up, we have Stereoscopic Readout with your lovely host, Darren. I will leave you with a little bit of background about something called a giant isopod. I found this great website with really fun songs that I will spin in a moment, but the giant isopod deserves a proper introduction. It may be one of approximately 9 species of large isopods. Basically, these are crustaceans that are related to shrimp and crabs, and it's part of the genus Bathynomus. Giant isopods are thought to be abundant in cold, deep waters of the Atlantic, and Bathynomus giganteus is the species upon which the giant isopod is based. It's the largest known isopod and one of the most often referred to by the name giant isopod. And why are they called giant isopods? Well, they're kind of like a wood louse that you have to hold in two hands. They mature to a length of 19 to 37 centimeters, so about 8 to 15 inches long, and they reach a weight of about 3 pounds. And they, in fact, closely resemble their terrestrial cousins, the wood lice. So wood lice are also isopods, but they live on land. Giant isopods are generalist scavengers. They're mostly carnivorous, and they eat dead whales, fish, and squid. But there is a theory that they could be active predators of slow-moving prey like sea cucumbers or sponges, and maybe even live fish. It's debatable whether an isopod is truly cute. The Wikipedia website has what I think is a rather cute photo of an isopod. Its belly is exposed. It looks kind of neat. But head on, they look kind of creepy. They have really reflective eyes, and they look a little bit predatory. But there is a group of researchers who study the giant isopod who have named themselves Team Isopod! And they love the isopod, and particularly the giant isopod, so much that they have composed and performed an array of different musical pieces. And the one that I will play for you today is from their MySpace page, www.myspace.com/thegiantisopods, and it is called An Isopod is Cute. So that's it for me. Have a great next couple of weeks, and see you in about a month's time.
An isopod is cute in the eyes of an isopod.